Our first speaker is John Ackbrenner from the PHIL at the Wellcome Trust Center for Neuroimaging. John actually doesn't need an introduction. If you don't know John, he shouldn't be here. But I should mention a couple of things. Those of you who do know him probably know him as one of the principal developers of ESPM software, and in particular, the inventor of the voxel-based morphometry method that is the most widely used method for, quote, mapping anatomy in population studies, as this session is entitled, so it's perfectly appropriate that John's headlining this session. And for these contributions, he's received the Wiley Young Investigator Award from the organization Human Brain Mapping, and has been punished by being assigned the area editor for image processing in NeuroImage. He's done such a great job. In any case, looking forward to it.
Thanks, Jim. Well, it's great to be here. I came to the IPOM meeting 4 years ago, and I learned a lot, but mostly after the IPOM meeting. I just introduced to this completely different world and did a lot of reading afterwards. So it taught me more about what I didn't know than what. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about pre-processing strategies for the method of voxel-based morphometry. Voxel-based morphometry was actually first used in about 1995. I think Carl Friston probably invented it, but I kind of became associated with it in about 2001. And this is an overview of what I'm going to be talking about, so just be a quick introduction to what the pre-processing strategies are for voxel-based morphometry, then a little bit about segmentation, and then some stuff about the dartle inter-subject registration stuff that I developed recently. So the idea behind voxel-based morphometry is that we have a number of anatomical scans, typically T1 weighted, of many different subjects, possibly two separate populations of subjects, or subjects that have been characterized in some way. And we pre-process them in order to generate spatially normalized or kind of warped into a standard space versions of their usually gray matter. And these pre-processed images are spatially smoothed by 8 to 12 millimeters or so. And then we perform voxel-wise statistics and interpret these statistical differences using Gaussian random field theory in order to make corrections for multiple dependent comparisons. And we hope to try to interpret the findings in terms of volumetric differences. Steve Smith yesterday kind of mentioned voxel-based morphometry applied to diffusion data, which I don't really consider as voxel-based morphometry. Morphometry is the study of form. If you look on the Wikipedia definition, you see describing form rather than the composition of different tissues. So that wasn't really a voxel-based morphometry thing that Steve was mentioning yesterday. So again, this is a little overview. So we segment, then we spatially normalize, and when we warp, we scale according to... We scale the grey matter maps to account for the amount of contraction or expansion, so that after the warping, within each region, the integral of the amount of grey matter within each region should be preserved from the original images. Do the mass univariate testing, and then inference using Gaussian random field theory. So the smoothing, the idea of the smoothing is to compute an average of the volume of grey matter around a particular region. So if these little dots were voxels of grey matter, we could convolve these dots with a circular function, and that would give us a count of the number of grey matter voxels around the centre of each circle. In practice, we tend to use a Gaussian smoothing kernel, and that gives us a weighted average of the volume of grey matter. So if the images are all spatially normalised, it's like applying a region of interest on the... Well, the circular version is like applying a region of interest, a circular region of interest around each point. So it gives us how much grey matter there is around each part of the brain. And then when we do the statistics, we try to interpret the results in terms of volumetric differences. But really what we're testing is we're looking for significant differences among the pre-processed data. So we hope that the pre-processing is good in order to give a more meaningful interpretation of our findings. So if we compared the amount of grey matter in this circle with the amount of grey matter in this circle, we would see a difference, and in this case the difference would be due to some kind of folding difference. Whoops. Or the differences we see could be attributed to cortical thickening or thinning. It's also possible to have systematic differences between populations due to, you know, misclassification of tissues. Maybe the grey matter intensities are slightly different in one population compared to another population, and we might find systematic volumetric differences or systematic differences in the pre-processed data that are merely a result of tissue misclassification. Or the big one is misregistration, and this is a criticism of voxel-based morphometry that Fred Buchstein pointed out a number of years ago. So in order to make it easier to interpret the findings, it's important that we try to, you know, improve the registration accuracy as much as we can, and the tissue classification accuracy as much as we can. So most of my talk is going to be devoted to, you know, a strategy that we have for tissue classification and a strategy that we have for kind of improving or attempting to improve the inter-subject registration. So the next bit is about segmentation. Segmentation in SPM uses a mixture of Gaussian's model, but there's an intensity modulation. There's a bias correction built into the tissue segmentation model, and then there's a little bit of registration involved as well. Because if we know approximately where grey matter should be located, we can use that information to help to try to improve the accuracy of the segmentation. So when we do things with images, it's quite often to think of things in terms of a pipeline where we do one thing and then we do another thing to the data and then we do another thing. So typically we'd start off with a skull stripping and then maybe a bias correction and then a registration and a tissue segmentation. But the order that we do things doesn't always make sense because there's a certain amount of circularity. If we bias correct the data, then it makes it easier to do the registration or tissue classification. If we've done registration or tissue classification, it becomes easy to do bias correction. So everything is kind of linked in. So you know the excuse me, the simple pipeline procedure may not be ideal. So the strategy that I adopted was to try to build everything into a kind of unified generative model where all the different components of the model are considered together. And within this model, I tried to make it Bayesian, but you know, doing it properly Bayesian is tricky. So I've just gone for simple map estimates of a bunch of parameters. But behind the model, the whole thing can be thought of as a generative model. We've heard a little bit about generative models so far. And there are a number of components to the model. So if these Ys are the intensities of the individual voxels, then some of the kind of hidden parameters of the model are, you know, which tissue class they belong to. And then there's a number of parameters that describe the probability of the prior probabilities of each voxel belonging to a particular tissue class. And then there's models for the intensity distribution of the different tissue classes and model for the bias field, and everything is kind of combined within this same model. But the basic framework is a mixture of Gaussians. So if you do a histogram of the intensity of the intensities of the different voxels, you'll find some kind of distribution. And this distribution can be modeled by a linear combination of Gaussians. So each of these Gaussians is parameterized by its mean, its variance, if it's a multispectral segmentation by a covariance. And there's also a mixing proportion, which is essentially the integral of the integral under the Gaussian. So this simply represents the probability of obtaining a particular intensity given a vector of means, a series of covariances, and some mixing proportions, and it's simply linear combination of Gaussians. Once we've fitted the model, we can work out the probability that any particular intensity was drawn from any particular Gaussian. So that's simply by dividing, well, for any intensity, divide the amplitude of the Gaussian by the amplitude of the sums of the Gaussians, and that gives you the probability that the voxel, you know, that particular intensity would come from that particular Gaussian. So those we can refer to those as belonging probabilities, and the actual mixture of Gaussians model involves an EM strategy where there's an alternation between working out which voxel, which Gaussians each of the voxels is drawn from, and then if you know which Gaussians the voxels are drawn from, you can recompute the means and variances and the integrals under each Gaussian, and then you can re-estimate, you know, the belonging probabilities, and you keep alternating between the two strategies. Particular tissues may not have Gaussian intensity distributions, so it's also possible to, say, model grey matter by a number of Gaussians, and by using more than one Gaussian, you can model non-Gaussian intensity distributions for, say, grey matter, white matter, CSF, and various other tissues. A bias field can be built into the model. This would just be by introducing this. This row is intended to represent a bias field. It's parameterized by, you know, a vector beta. And it just involves a slight change to the model of the intensities of the particular voxels. So probability of obtaining this intensity from this particular tissue class, given the parameters of that Gaussian and the bias field, is simply this. So if we have an intensity corrupted image, the idea would be to try to estimate the bias field that eliminates the intensity variations among the white matter and amongst the grey matter. And this bias field could be modelled by a linear combination of basis functions. So this beta vector would be the coefficients for this linear combination. But in practice, we use a linear combination of basis functions, and then we take the exponential of that, and that ensures that the bias field remains positive. We can make use of tissue probability maps to give us a prior probability that any particular voxel should belong to a particular tissue class. So if these maps are overlaid onto the image that we want to segment, then that can be used to make the segmentation easier and more robust. These are data that I got from the Monique a few years ago and kind of tweaked them slightly. And note that we have an extra tissue class which wasn't represented by the grey, white, the CSF. I could achieve a more robust solution if there was a few non-brain tissue classes. So if there was a tissue class, so this is a little request, a tissue class for skull and for various other soft tissues. So we get a model of everything that we see in the image rather than just build a model of a subset of the image, the brain part. But in order to make use of these tissue probability maps to help the segmentation, we need to deform them in order that they can be overlaid onto the image that we want to segment. I've just used a very simple deformation model. So the deformation simply consists of a linear combination of cosine transform bases. So there'd only be about 1,000 parameters to describe the full shape variability. But since the tissue probability maps are just based on affine registered images, probably don't need that many parameters. Probably using more parameters wouldn't improve the accuracy with which the tissue probability maps are overlaid. And there's also a little scaling function in there as well. So, and this allows the model to kind of assume, you know, a greater proportion or a smaller proportion of grey matter to white matter, or, you know, more CSF or less CSF or whatever. But this is essentially the prior probability. It's a model for the prior probability of obtaining grey matter, white matter, CSF, and other stuff at any particular voxel location. But once all these parameters have been, you know, put into the same model, we've got a single objective function here that we want to try to optimize. There'd also be some regularization terms as well to keep the deformation smooth and to keep the estimated bias field smooth. But the parameters are simply the means of the Gaussians, the variances of the Gaussians, these little kind of mixing proportion things that scale the tissue probability maps, the estimate of the bias field, and the parameters describing the deformations. And yeah, this whole thing would be optimized, and the strategy I use for optimization is the means and variances and mixing proportions are kind of optimized using an EM-like strategy, and then I go on to do a Gauss-Newton or a Liebenberg-Marquardt to optimize the bias field parameters and the deformation parameters. So you think of, you know, a bunch of parameters that are, you know, so it's like a, you know, very high dimensional space, but just imagine two sets of parameters. So you optimize one set of parameters, and that brings you slightly closer to the solution, and then you optimize the next set. If you didn't consider everything within the same model, then essentially you'd be stopping here. But if you continue on, you get closer to the optimum. And because the intensity distributions are estimated from the data itself, it should be possible to throw a wide variety of different image contrasts at the algorithm and still obtain a reasonable solution. So these are just these are simulated data from the MNI, and these are the resulting tissue classifications. The model's not always ideal. Because it assumes that grey matter always has, you know, the same intensity distribution, which isn't necessarily true. If you look at as Bruce Fischel pointed out on Monday, I think, the intensities of, let's say, grey matter in the thalamus is very different to the intensities of grey matter in the cortex, on the cortical surface. So that's a strategy that we use for identifying different tissue types within the brain. Then the next step is to try to improve the accuracy with which we can do the intersubject registration. The segmentation approach does estimate some nonlinear deformations, but because it only uses about 1,000 parameters, it doesn't give you a really accurate registration. So the approach is refined. I use the parameters estimated by the segmentation to generate tissue class images that have been rigidly aligned to each other. So we use the nonlinear deformations estimated in the previous step in order to do a Procrustes alignment, weighting the alignment with the grey matter. So the refinement of the intersubject registration is done with something that I call the Dartle algorithm. I kind of wish maybe I'd given it a different name, because I'm not really sure I don't think it is a Lie algebra, is it? It's many people refer to it as a one-parameter subgroup, and it's similar to the framework that many people in INRIA have been working with. So you've heard about LDDMM. I forgot the right number of D's and M's in there. That parameterizes a deformation in terms of a number of velocities. So you've got time-varying velocity. I've taken a rather crude approximation where I've got a constant velocity that I integrate along from time zero to time one. So I've got this velocity field or flow field that I use for generating a kind of diffeomorphic map. So the idea of the algorithm is to estimate some flow field, and then that flow field is used for the integration in order to generate a smooth deformation. And it's kind of analogous to matrix exponentiation. And the generation of the deformation can be achieved using a scaling and squaring approach. So if we think about these equations, we have this differential equation describing the rate of change of the evolving deformation of a unit time. And this evolution can be done using an Euler integration procedure. So if we take tiny differences in the time, we could take the existing deformation and add a tiny version of the flow field warped by the current estimate of the deformation. And this is equivalent to this composition operator, this composition operation. So using a simple integration step, we can get the deformation at time 1 over 8 by a simple small deformation approximation. And then we can get the deformation at time 1/4 by composing this with itself. And then we can get the deformation at time 3/8 by doing this. And this would be the simple Euler integration approach, which requires 7 compositions. Alternatively, we can use a scaling and squaring approach, where we get the deformation at time 1/8. So we compose this with itself to get the deformation at time 1/4, compose that with itself to get the halfway deformation, and compose 2 halfway deformations to get the full deformation. And we can achieve the inverse of the deformation by starting with a small deformation model that subtracts the displacement field. So this is an illustration of that. So we get a very small deformation, compose that with itself, get a slightly bigger deformation, compose that with itself, and repeat that for a number of steps to get the final deformation. So if we have a C and a circle, we can warp one to the other. And if we look at the C at time minus 1, we see that approximately matches the circle. If we look at the circle at time 1, we see it approximately matches the C, and we get a match at the intermediate stages. And these are the deformations of those different times. We can do a similar procedure with the Jacobians. So the Jacobian tensor field can be generated at particular times by using a similar scaling squaring approach, and we get pretty much a one-to-one mapping. So these are a bunch of references that could be useful for understanding this procedure. I do want to point out, it is just an approximation. It's because things can be done with the scaling and squaring approach, and because there's just one single vector field to estimate it, it means the registration can be achieved in a reasonable time. But the framework isn't as good as the LDDMM framework. Cleve Muller's paper talks about matrix exponentiation. Then Assini, I don't know how to pronounce his name properly. Is Xavier here? He's done a couple of papers on the log Euclidean framework using this one parameter subgroup stuff, and then Monica Hernandez and has done some similar work. And Tom Vercoteren as well has also done some similar registration. So that's the model. That's the parameterization of the deformations. So when we actually do the registration, we need to do some kind of optimization procedure. And the optimization procedure involves the image matching term and a regularization term. The image matching term that I'm using differs from what was in my original paper on the subject, and it's intended to match binary images. So we can think of T as a binary image, or it could be a series of binary images indicating a number of different tissue types. And we have a template, mu, and we have a deformation. And the objective function is based on assuming a multinomial distribution. We assume that the template represents a deformable multinomial distribution. So when Bruce Fischel was talking, he mentioned kind of weighting the registration according to the residual variance. So where there's greater residual variance, you give less weighting to the registration. Using a multinomial distribution implicitly weights the registration, so that if there's a region where the template has a value of 0.5 and there's a lot of uncertainty, it weights the registration less heavily. And the idea of this is that, I'll get onto the idea of it later, maybe now's not the best time. But one of the requirements of this template is, because we're using logarithms, we don't want regions where the log is minus infinity, so regions are zeros, cause it problems. And then there's a regularization term. So I've used H, everyone else has been using L. So it's just... There's a number of different regularization terms that can be used by the Darcy algorithm. So, but generally, if we just have a tiny, say, 6x6 2D problem, then we'd have a matrix of this form, which would be, it's still fairly big. In practice, we have something like a 6 million by 6 million sparse matrix. So we've got this very sparse matrix with kind of toplets or circulant properties, which kind of regularizes our estimates of the flow field. So we have a number of coefficients that parameterize the flow field, and we have this regularization, this energy term that we're minimizing, while simultaneously optimizing the intensity matching part of the registration. The different regularization models have different, result in different effects on the estimated deformations. So if we deform, this is just using a small deformation model, but if we deform this circle to match the square with two different regularization models, we can achieve visually very similar results. But the estimated deformations would be very different. It's difficult to figure out what the optimal the optimal form of the regularization is. So far I've talked about what the objective function is. The two parts, there's the matching term and the regularization term. We want to find the coefficients of the flow field that would give us the best objective function. And for this I've used a Gauss-Newton optimization strategy, which can achieve very, very fast optimization. If we have an exactly quadratic cost function, then it would require just one iteration to converge, but in practice it needs a little more. But the basic strategy behind the Gauss-Newton is that we have an estimate of the flow field, and we simply take the second derivatives of the objective function and the first derivatives, and repeatedly update our estimate of the flow field. This H is the same one, is the regularization term. This large matrix that I showed you earlier, and this A is the second derivative of the likelihood term, which, if we use a trilinear interpolation, is simply again, it's a very large sparse matrix, but with stuff, most of the information on the diagonal and on a few of the off diagonals. And B is the first derivatives of the objective function. Both parts of the objective function. So we've got this big matrix inversion, this big matrix solution thing that we want to achieve. And because we're using these enormous sparse matrices, we want an efficient way of achieving a solution. So the strategy that we've adopted is one way of doing it is to use a relaxation approach. So if we have this set of linear equations, we want to estimate x. It's possible to do it by splitting this matrix M into two different parts. So we have a part that's easy to invert, and we have a part that's more difficult to invert. So typically, E would just be a diagonal matrix, and F would be what's left of that diagonal matrix. And we iterate using some form of relaxation scheme. So if this matrix is diagonally dominant, then we can use this simple relaxation strategy. Otherwise, I use a slightly more complicated strategy. But relaxation tends to fit the higher frequencies earlier, so we can relax and just keep iterating, and it would fit the higher frequencies, and then only eventually start to fit the low frequencies. Okay, this is another illustration of the matrices. So this is the regularization, the matrix that we use for the regularization. This is the form of the first derivatives, sorry, the second derivatives of the likelihood term. So for two dimensions, we have a diagonal and then some stuff on the off diagonal. And the sum of these two matrices will be the M on the previous slide, and then we can decompose this M into these matrices. So this E would be the easy part to invert, and the residuals would be, sorry, what was left would be the more difficult part to invert. And this matrix with stuff on the diagonal and on these off diagonals can be inverted by simply inverting a series of 2x2 matrices. So that's easy. This is hard. And these would be what's involved in the relaxation. But like I said, relaxation approaches generally fit the higher frequencies earlier than the lower frequencies. So in order to try to fit the lower frequencies, work on multiple spatial scales. So if we work on the at a very coarse resolution, we can do relaxation at a coarse resolution and then zoom that result up to a higher resolution, then do a few relaxation iterations to improve the result, zoom to a higher resolution, and so on. In practice, we use something slightly different. We obtain a solution at the coarsest resolution, which can be done exactly because we're just dealing with simple, you know, 3x3 or, you know, very small matrices. Zoom that up. Use relaxation to refine the solution, and then take the residuals and, you know, obtain an estimate for the residuals by projecting them to a coarser resolution, fitting the residuals at the coarse resolution, projecting up, relaxing, and then going up and down the scale, the spatial scales. So that kind of works fairly nicely. This is just, I'll skip over these. But there's more on this in numerical recipes, and I think most people have got a copy of numerical recipes kicking about somewhere. And I haven't read it, but I think probably... numerical recipes, let me think. Jan Matuszewski's got a book on optimization strategies for image registration. I think that book probably says something about multi-grid approaches and how they can be used for image registration. But the strategy I've used is I've assumed that the template represents a deformable multinomial distribution. But in order to generate the template, I'm going to use a strategy to actually estimate this deformable distribution. So a simple view of how this can be done. This is similar to Zarang's approach. Is to begin with all our approximately aligned images, compute an average, use that average as a template, and then warp all the images slightly closer to this average, generate a new average of all the warped images, and keep repeating, probably using a heavier regularization in the early stages and a lighter regularization at the later stages, and that eventually gives you a crisper average. These were generated using a kind of least squares objective function. So the whole lot can be thought of in terms of a kind of generative model. So if we were to maximize the joint probabilities of everything, so probability of all the deformations and all the data and the template, then we would get these probability equations. But I've chosen to include a prior probability over the template. Some people use a kind of hyper-template approach, but I've chosen to use kind of smoothness priors, because we know that these binary images, we know that the images have got some kind of structure to them. They're not like random noise. So I've used a Laplacian smoothness prior. So if we consider a sample from the generative model, it's essentially kind of random noise convolved with the Green's function and then passed through some squashing function. So depending on how much squashing we want to do, we get different levels of contrast between the the ones and the zeros. So here we've got, you know, ones and zeros and a number of different gray levels between, whereas this is much closer to ones and zeros, where, you know, the intensity has been squashed much more. So I've got this prior on the template. And rather than just estimating the means of these multinomial distributions, I've estimated this field of A's, which is kind of like a Gaussian process that gets squashed. So I have this parameterization, and the idea is to estimate these A's, these A fields. And this, again, is done using Gauss-Newton optimization. And I've got a multigrid implementation, and I'm damn well going to use it. So I use the multigrid strategy to estimate these regularized templates, these smoother templates. And by making use of the smoothness priors, it kind of eliminates the zeros in the averages that would cause problems when you take logarithms. So if we have, you know, more precisely registered images, would the kind of regularization term on the smoothing would be lower. We need a less regularization. So you don't see much difference between, you know, the simple maximum likelihood estimate of the averages, mm-hmm. and the map estimate that's used the regularization. But if we take logarithms, we don't get zero. We don't get kind of minus infinity in the templates. If we have less precisely aligned images, then more smoothing, you know, gives you a better probabilistic model. So we see a bigger difference between the maximum likelihood estimates and the map estimates. And we also see that the effect of the templates is kind of propagated a bit, so it kind of eliminates... it gives, you know, a bigger capture range to the registration. These are some averages. So this is an average of grey matter from 471 subjects. That's white matter. This is an average of the individual image. This is an average of the raw images after warping. That's an individual after warping. So, yeah, some regions it does pretty well, other regions it does a bit less well. Let's back to the average. Another randomly chosen individual. Another individual, back to the average. This is a little bit of selling of SPM. So this is our user interface. So if we have a couple of scans of two subjects, well, if we have T1 weighted scans of two subjects, we'd use the segmentation routine to estimate the, you know, the various distributions that we use for obtaining tissue class images. But the import step of the Dartle tools is used for generating this rigidly aligned grey matter, white matter maps. And then actually run the registration software and write out the warped, oh no, run the registration software to get the aligned grey matter images and white matter images. But these are actually scaled by the Jacobians of the deformations, and then we simply smooth the data. So we'd have images like this for all the subjects, and we can put those into the general linear model and make our inferences about where we appear to have more or less grey matter in particular populations as opposed to other populations. And yeah, that's it. Thanks.
Are there any questions for John?
Yeah, I have a question. You talked about the image mesh, and you said you have binary images. But the segmentation of your, result of your segmentations are probability images.
The sets of probabilities
that sum up to one.
Yeah, but I'm assuming that they're approximately binary images.
Okay. But so could you do the registration test on the probability tissue maps?
I actually use the probability images. The tissue probabilities, but because they're very close to binary, I don't think it makes so much difference.
But if you do gray and white, you would not do that simultaneously. So you run your registration.
The gray and white is done simultaneously.
In the registration.
In the registration, yeah.
Steve,
so John, when you you're looking at basically local gray matter density, and some people like the idea instead of using an explicit classical model, like for example you get with precept and measuring classical thickness. It might be interesting to people if you can comment on the relative merits.
I guess it depends on the theories that you have about what kinds of differences you expect among your populations. If you're expecting some kind of atrophy, then you know, more direct measures of cortical thickness would make more sense. But if you're assuming that, you know, that there could be more kind of folding in certain conditions, then some kind of surface area approach might be more useful. And voxel-based morphometry is just trying to find you know, how gray matter differences. So it could be something to do with thickening, or it could be something to do with changes in surface area. It doesn't try to disambiguate the two.
Any other questions?
Well, okay, maybe just following up on Steve's question, the other alternative is tensor-based morphometry. So looking at the deformation fields themselves, and you have the interesting picture there where they could be actually very different depending on the prior terms that you use. So do you have, I guess, similar question, you know, thoughts about, you know, using a VBM type method versus a tensor based type method and implications?
Well, with the Dartle stuff, the deformations are not as kind of meaningfully parameterized as they would be with something like LEDMM. So you can consider these circles as being like the templates, and these will be the individual subjects. And it estimates these flow fields. And if we kind of whiten these flow fields by the H matrix, the L matrix, we see something that, you know, this is the kind of underlying parameterization of the deformations that we have. Whereas with the LDDMM approach, if we have a number of flow fields over time, we can pre-whiten them. And if we look at the initial flow field, we can obtain, you know, the initial momentum map, and we compare that across individuals. We can see that the differences are kind of, the deformations, the information encoding the deformations is kind of in register, whereas with this, the deformations the parameterizations of the deformations are not so much in register. So I have tried using a multivariate approach on the parameterizations of the deformations, and I don't find that I can get as accurate predictions as I can if I simply use the kind of voxel-based morphometry pre-processed type data. But I think with kind of a more meaningful representation of the, of the deformations, it should do rather better. So does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I also think you're being very generous, and
I'm being honest.
Well, generous, honest. But you're, I think in terms of how to integrate this with UTI, which was also the question, it's very natural, and no doubt you're starting to do it, you're doing the kinds of things that we've been doing with Susumu, in which you now bring into your matching terms. I mean, you're all set up, you have matching terms, you talked about how your matching terms work. Into your matching terms, things that represent directional information that we get from, from DTI, whether you measure that through FA or you measure that other ways. And so you're set up for that, and it's very natural. You've reduced you've encoded shape into your you. Not our momentum, but your you, and that's where you would use statistics. So perhaps you're suggesting that you see that your you is not as well localized in terms of the template geometry. And if that's a finding, I mean, that would be a good thing for people that are going to ask, okay, one's more computationally efficient than the other. What are the, I want computational efficiency, I'm willing to trade off this other feature if there's another feature or not. That would be a nice thing to show.
I've kind of thought about using a number of, composing a number of Dartle steps together, and then looking at the gradients of the template multiplied, no, it didn't work. It's not quite the same for the multinomial distribution. But if it was a least squares objective function, if you compute the gradients of the template, multiplied by the difference between the template and the deformed individual with a scaling by the Jacobian, then you get an approximation to the initial momentum. And seeing how this changes with varying the number of constant velocity steps that are used in the registration, so maybe you can get by with just
maybe
three.
Maybe you need a couple, a few.
Maybe you just need a few.
If a large motion is four voxels, right? We ought to expect that in any motion we can sort of move one voxel. So four times is the order of what we need. Mm. We don't need to go 30. We don't need to do the same almost all the time. This might be very efficient.
Yeah, so there could be more efficient ways of doing it.
You brought up a really interesting point about comparing your different deformation, your different regularization methods, and how different the deformations were depending on which one you chose. And it's an issue that will end up in any of the deformation methods. LBDMM has its own form of regularization. Have you seen any sort of biologically inspired models for which one might actually produce more meaningful results?
No, I haven't. But you'd expect there to be some model that is good, based on simplicity. Like, for example, if you take a sample from a random distribution, a model that gives you like 10% variability in volume at a small spatial scale and gives you 10% variability at a larger spatial scale, some kind of spatial invariance like that may be more plausible or simple in some way. Similarly, gives you a nice rotational invariance, so globally rotationally invariant and translationally invariant may also be good. But figuring out the best H or L is tricky. In principle, it's a type two maximum likelihood problem, because the dimensionality is so big. You know, there's traces of inverses of matrices that are very difficult to compute, or logs of determinants of matrices that are very difficult to compute. I don't know how to do the estimation properly. But cross-validation could be used. Just, for example, something similar to what Jim did a number of years ago. If you got information that in the images that you kind of hide from the registration algorithm, for example, just by using, you know, part of the image for the registration and see how well the deformations interpolate over the bit that was left out, that would be a kind of cross-validation strategy that might do the job.
Okay, I'd like to thank John once more.